Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder joining us. You know, we're going to be talking about the building, the scaling, the financing, all of that good stuff. We're going to be talking about not only success, but also lessons learned along the way with another attempt at entrepreneurship too. And, you know, other stuff that we're going to be talking about, why, you know, starting a company for the right reasons is the way to go. How to think about adding value, you know, whether it is with finding your business model or with new lines of revenue for your company. And then also how to think about being persistent around finding perhaps product market fit. So again, quite an inspiring conversation ahead of us. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Evan Richardson. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here and talk to you.
So originally born in Kansas, but you moved quite a bit, you know, growing up. You also walked through memory lane. How was life for you during the early years?
Yeah, you know, it was great. I was born in Kansas City, lived there for probably 6 years or so. My father was in the beverage alcohol industry and worked behind the counter in a liquor store for the first 4 or 5 years of life. And then he moved from there into more of the corporate world. And we started to move around. We spent, like I said, 6 years or so in Kansas City. We spent about a year in St. Louis. We spent 4 or 5 years in Denver. We spent 4 or 5 years in Los Angeles and then finished out high school in Fort Worth, Texas. So quite the variety of scenery.
And sounds like a lot of moving. So how was it like for you to developing that sense for uncertainty so early on in your life? Because it's new friends, new location, new everything.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a challenge for any kid kind of resetting their social structure and kind of resetting their cultural values a lot. I do think, though, there's a ton of value to it. I think that, you know, one of the things that it teaches you is to, you know, find your sort of mission, find your motivation in yourself. Because with your friends groups changing all the time, with, you know, the schools that you're in or anything else like that changing all the time, you definitely can't find it outside. And I think, you know, it teaches you to, you know, to not depend too heavily on that perspective of others for what's right and wrong or for what you want to be doing, et cetera. So, you know, I think though it was a challenge, and I think, you know, of course, probably not surprisingly, the biggest challenge was moving right in the middle of high school from Los Angeles, California, in a school that was, you know, probably 70% non-white, to Fort Worth, Texas, a school that was 97% white and had very different cultural expectations. So that was a challenge. You know, I think today, I think I probably have an ability to feel at home in a lot of different situations with a lot of different people. And so I think there's real value there.
So out of all things, you got into computer science. You know, that's why you went to study at Dartmouth. So why computer science?
Yeah, great question. You know, I'd always been pretty interested in computing. I think, you know, I remember going to the library and getting a book on Quick Basic when I was in, gosh, must have been in sixth grade, you know, and writing like everybody else, the, you know, their first Hello World program and being pretty darn proud of it. And so I had been interested in what you could do if you wrote code for a long time, and had a strong interest in math. And, you know, for me, as I was going into school, along with, you know, everything else that you want to spend your time doing in undergrad, I was pretty focused on either math or computing. And to me, you know, computing just felt a lot more practical. I always thought about it as learning a trade. And I felt like, gosh, you know, if you have this skill set, then, you know, you'll always have something you can fall back on. So to me, it was about practicality, but it was also just a lot of, you know, personal interest.
But when you do computer science, you either become an engineer or you perhaps, you know, launch your own startup. So why going into consulting with Bain?
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, I think I spent probably a little bit more time working in undergrad than a lot of folks. I came into Dartmouth and I was fortunate to have about a year's worth of credit. And so instead of doing fun things like going off and spending my time doing study abroad or things that I would have probably a lot better time doing, I ended up doing a bunch of internships, and I did them at, you know, at computing shops. But I kind of got bad luck when I was selecting those internships. I think I ended up working in a few really old school, kind of old line computing shops. One of them, you know, I was writing C++ compilers for the DEC Alpha platform, which was a supercomputer platform that was popular in the 1980s. And what I saw was just, you know, a really, really challenging, uninteresting world of kind of slow moving corporate interactions. And to me, you know, I said, this isn't where I want to be spending my time. I think if I had landed, you know, out in California, if I'd been, you know, in the early days, like some of my classmates did, doing, you know, an internship at Google when it was just a few hundred folks, I probably would have had a pretty different perspective on it. But, you know, luck plays a role in a lot of these things. And I said, the heck with this, I got to go find something else to do. I remember, you know, having a real kind of come to Jesus moment my senior year. And saying, I got to find something else besides computing because the real world of computing is just so different than what I enjoy. And so I, you know, I changed all of my interviewing plans and ended up going and working at Bain & Co., which was a great spot to be. And I think I was pretty focused on entrepreneurship at the time. And to me, it made a lot of sense to go and learn a lot of the basics of how companies worked. And so instead of starting something on my own early when I felt like I didn't know anything, to me, you know, it made a lot of sense to go and learn the basics of how companies worked.
So with the consulting at Bain and then also with the private equity that you did at Berkshire Partners, what did you learn about patterns when it comes to success or failure in business?
Yeah. You know, I think there's a bunch of key lessons. You know, I think probably the most important lesson I learned on the consulting side is, you know, strategy is about what you do different. One of the things that to me was a little bit mind-blowing when we first sat down, or when I first sat down and got to be part of some of the conversations at, you know, in the consulting side, was, gosh, we talked a lot as consultants about bringing, you know, kind of creative thinking or, you know, bringing new perspectives, but a lot of the brass tacks work that we did was about benchmarking to industry standards. And what I saw was, you know, we were really good at helping companies do what everybody else did well, or bring them kind of to that, you know, top quartile performance and whatever we looked at, but that never really differentiated them. And so, you know, it was an insight that I got more through seeing what I didn't think worked, which was doing everything the same way as your competitors, and really drove home to me the need to differentiate your approach. If you're going to do something, if it's going to make a real difference in the success or failure of your company, it has to be around what you do different. And you need to think a lot more about those areas you're choosing to be different from your competition and carve out a unique area than you do about sort of all those other areas that aren't going to make as much of a difference and where it may be fine to just be, you know, top quartile of your competitive set.
So then why did you think, hey, maybe I, you know, put the brakes and I go back to studying?
Yeah. You know, I think for me, it felt like there was a real decision point. You know, I was very fortunate to spend a couple of years in private equity, learned a ton about doing deals, learned a ton about basic financial operations of companies all the way up through, you know, financial engineering of deals, financial engineering of companies to really drive value. But to me, there was a real hard choice, which was, you know, stick in that industry, stay in private equity, where, you know, look, there's been a fantastic kind of money spending machine that has been built by a lot of firms over the course of the last 30 years in the world of leveraged buyouts. And it was very clear that you could stay there, you could do well by yourself and your family, and you could produce value for your investors. But there just wasn't a real opportunity for creativity, right? I really saw the choice there as you know, sticking around and kind of turning the crank on a money machine that was absolutely going to produce money. You know, I was going to be doing things the same way as I had been doing and as others had been doing for, you know, 20, 30 years before. And to me, that just didn't seem like the place that I wanted to spend my next 30 years. And so going back to school and going back for an MBA was, you know, really an opportunity to kind of hit a little bit, maybe not reset, but really have that kind of breakpoint to say, all right, let's take some real consideration of what we want to do. Let's find that next opportunity to be more creative and really to dive back into entrepreneurship.
So after basically the experience doing your MBA with Harvard, what you do is you move to Palo Alto. And this is as a result of your now wife. You know, she was a physician and she, you know, went there to Stanford and you went with her. And as a result of that, you got that exposure to basically healthcare and healthcare services. It sounds like that was a pivotal moment in your life, right? When you were exposed to this segment. And it's interesting because instead of going into that path, for the first time when you became a founder, you don't go into healthcare, you go into financial services. I mean, that's quite the 180 there. What happened?
Yeah, that's, well, you know, it's a great question. So this is not a, the startup that you're talking about is not one that, that I'm not sure I've ever actually even talked about it in a podcast or in a public setting before, but, you know, I was at Castlight, which was a early innovator in sort of this iteration of health tech innovation. And I'd been there for a couple of years. And I, as I mentioned, you know, I had been very focused on starting a company. And I'd set as a personal goal for myself that within, you know, 2 years of graduating from grad school, I was going to go out and start something. And, you know, I had plenty of reasons why that made a bunch of sense. And so just as I was creeping up on that 2 year mark, I was working very hard to find the next thing that I wanted to go spend time on. And I jumped. And I think, you know, the reason that I left had a lot more to do with that kind of goal that I'd set for myself, right? It was a very arbitrary timeline, right? And, you know, I ultimately worked on something that made sense from my previous life, right? Because I'd come from the finance world. I'd come from consulting. I'd come from sort of that analytical world. And I'd only spent about 18 months in health tech at the time. And so I did. I worked on starting a company in the what is now sort of thought of as the robo-advising space, you know, a competitor to Wealthfront or companies like that. And, you know, I think a lot of the pieces that I knew I had to bring into place, whether that was founding team, whether that was, you know, product market fit, whether that was the technology stack that we leveraged, et cetera, a lot of the pieces that I pulled into place over the 6 months that I was actively working on that company, a lot of it was done more out of sort of, you know, a sense of, hey, this is the plan and this is what makes sense, without listening to what the data was that I was seeing in market, without really listening to, you know, what I was seeing from my founding team, without really listening to where the market had started to evolve to. A lot of it was, you know, sort of very focused on the initial goals that I had laid out, the initial plan, and not being very responsive. And it was a disaster, right? You know, I think I ultimately sunk, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 of cash out of my own pocket working to bootstrap. You know, we hired a team overseas. We didn't manage them right, but we were trying to manage to some timelines that again, we had sort of arbitrarily set down. I chose a founding partner who, you know, with a little bit of personal insight, I probably could have figured out was not going to be a great match. You know, he had a bunch of challenges. And ultimately, you know, we got to sort of the end of that 5 or 6 month period with really nothing but like a smoldering hole in the ground, right? We worked hard and yet, you know, because I think we just weren't responsive to the data we were seeing, you know, we ultimately got to a spot where it was very clear that there was no go forward path.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So how was that moment where you decide that there's no go forward path? I mean, that pulling the plug, I'm sure it was very painful.
I think it was. I was fortunate because I think one thing that I did do right was, you know, I had been spending time on multiple projects. And so, you know, my co-founder on this financial advisory company that I was working on, you know, disappeared for a week or a week and a half, kind of resurfaced and told me they'd had a psychotic break. You know, at about the same time, our developers were coming back and, you know, showing us the work that they had done, but none of it worked and there wasn't anything there. I had been spending a bunch of time with another founder who I respected tremendously, who was working on a healthcare tech startup. And, you know, he and I had been talking about how he could go to market. He and I had been talking a bunch about the pieces of infrastructure that he was going to need to put into place. And he and another healthcare tech founder, who is the chair of interventional radiology at Stanford, had been working on a company that was becoming Grand Rounds at the time. And, you know, I fit really well into that group, right, as the sort of product piece of their troika, where we had one healthcare person, we had one, you know, sort of startup business focused person, we had one person who could drive product. And, you know, I think it was very fortunate that those pieces came together at the same time that, you know, the other work that I'd done was really starting to slow down.
So let's talk about joining that company, you know. So ultimately, the company that you ended up joining was Included Health, you know, that's the name that it became. And you were part of the founding team there. And there, you know, it was quite a great opportunity for you to look into how to keep figuring things out, like figuring areas of value ultimately. So as a founder, I guess as part of being in the venture world, what kind of exposure did that give you that really helped you out to become the founder that you are today with Form Health?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest, well, probably a lot of learnings from Grand Rounds. And I think one of the most important ones, though, was a real focus on value and a focus on continuing to expand the value that we were providing to our customers. And, you know, the CEO there, Owen Tripp, has a tremendous nose for continuing to expand share of wallet, expand value to customers, et cetera. And I think, you know, one of the things that we were incredibly successful at doing was year after year expanding the value we were delivering to our customers. We started as an expert opinion company, and that meant that we worked with employers. We allowed their employees to go and get a second opinion for their healthcare. It's a pretty niche area. When we started that part of the business, you know, we did our quick TAM calculation. We thought it was a multi-billion dollar market. And a couple of years in, we did that TAM calculation for the board. And we said, gosh, maybe it's like a couple hundred million dollars. And maybe we're going to have to figure out sort of another, you know, way to go here. And so we had already started to have a bunch of insight around quality of care, around finding high quality physicians. And we started to expand that into the navigation business. And so we built this expert opinion company into a navigation business. And from there, continued to expand sort of all the different things that we did for those employer companies. And then, you know, they've carried that forward very, very effectively, right? They purchased Doctor On Demand and integrated all of those services. And today are the largest provider of nav and teleprimary services out there from a company that started as a pretty niche provider of expert opinions. And I think, you know, that path is essential for anybody that's looking to really develop a high impact, high importance, high value company over time, because almost no matter what you start with, it's going to be too small for your vision. And you've got to be focused on how you can continue to expand the value you provide to whoever your customers are and expand the markets that you address over time, really in order to have a company that matches at least most entrepreneurs' vision.
So Form Health, you know, was the next chapter and the next company that that you take an attempt at as a founder. So Form Health, what ended up becoming Form Health? What is the business model there? How do you guys make money?
Yeah. So Form is the largest provider of high quality obesity care in the country today. That means that we work with patients who want to help get treatment for their obesity, for their weight. And we work with them in a holistic model. We treat their comorbidities that cause weight gain. We work to make sure they're on appropriate medication that doesn't cause weight gain. We deploy dietetic and activity pathways for those patients to make sure that they're actively losing weight. And then we wrap all of that with medication. So about 90% of our patients are on medication. Some of those are on, you know, these medications that you've probably heard about, like GLP-1s, Wegovy, Zepbound, other medications. Many of them are on lower cost, more broadly available medications. And we work with those patients to drive great results. We do that largely through working with employers and other large partners. And so when we work with employers, we work to make sure that their employees get the best results, which is really important from a value perspective for the employers, because of course, employers are mostly footing the bill for all of the medication and all the treatment. And so they want to make sure that when a patient does get treatment, they're getting the best possible outcomes. And that's what we do. High quality care, high value care, and great outcomes for patients.
So then in that regard also, how have you guys gone about the financing cycles here? You know, how much capital have you guys raised to date, and what has been the journey of raising the money?
Yeah, we've raised about $65 million. You know, I think the the first dollars that we brought in were in, you know, 2019. You know, I think I was fortunate to have spent a bunch of time around the early stage venture capital and sort of venture fundraising world. And so had a bunch of folks that I was able to talk to and pretty quickly put a seed round together. You know, at the time it was pretty typical. We raised about $4 million in that seed round and we're off to the races. You know, we did an A that was in about 2021, and boy, was that a different fundraising environment than some of the other rounds that we did since. We also, you know, I think were able to grow through some of what has been a fairly challenging market from a fundraising perspective for health tech companies, especially since, you know, right around Jan-Feb of 22, when I think a lot of the world started to shift for health tech companies. And so then we have continued to grow the company pretty tremendously, and we completed a B earlier this year, which we were excited about.
So how is it like to go from like early stage to growth stage, you know, which is really, you know, completing a B?
Yeah, you know, I think for us, the thing that has been most interesting to see is really just this explosion of patient perspective, or patient awareness, I should say, of the sector. You know, we started out, when we started the company, really the biggest challenge that we had was helping patients to understand that obesity care existed, that, you know, that some of the medications for treating obesity, that the sector that we work in, obesity medicine, was, you know, was real and legitimate care. That world changed pretty dramatically during COVID, right? You know, I think, you know, TikTok helped to alert the world that things like Ozempic or other GLP-1s were out there and could have a major impact for patients. And today, you know, we often spend a lot of our time talking to patients about other treatments that may or may not be GLP-1s, that may be more effective for them, that may be appropriate given their healthcare coverage, their health insurance coverage, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think, you know, that world has really changed, and that's really helped, that patient awareness has tremendously helped to accelerate the business. That's a hard one to have foreseen. And I think, you know, as I look back over my last, you know, 25 years in business, I think it's hard to ignore the fact that, you know, you've always got to put in the time, you've always got to put in the hours, you've always got to make that effort. And you can never really map out exactly what's going to happen. It was impossible for us to know that, you know, mid-21, the world would suddenly get wise to the existence of GLP-1s. And that while GLP-1s had been in market for 10 plus years, the sector was about to absolutely explode. And yet, because we were there, because we were working hard, we were ready for that uplift when it happened. But I think that, you know, Every entrepreneur, they'd be lying to you if they didn't say that those kind of unexpected moments didn't play a really material role in the growth of their companies or their own personal trajectory. And so I think that, you know, that's been one of the more interesting takeaways over time.
So when you receive money, you know, they're betting on a vision, just like employees or customers would do. So I guess the question there is, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Evan, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Form Health is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, I guess I would say that world where vision, where the vision for Form is fully realized, is really one where every patient has access to high quality cardiometabolic care. And that may sound like a mouthful, but if you take a step back and you look at the challenge for the world's healthcare system outside of developing economies where it's, you know, really basic healthcare that is the biggest challenge, the biggest challenge in the developed world is cardiometabolic, you know, BMI, weight, cardiac, diabetes, et cetera. All of these are tied together. And what we do at Form is we treat the central driver, weight, for all of those diseases. And so I think the fully realized vision for Form is driving access, driving fantastic care for patients, and really in doing that, driving down the total cost of care in the world healthcare system.
So then let's talk about the, we're talking about the future. I want to talk about the past, but with a lens of reflection. Imagine if I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time. Maybe that point where you were thinking about building something of your own and giving the notice at Castlight. And let's say you're able to have a chat with your younger self and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think, you know, probably the biggest thing would be, you know, Horatio Alger probably got more right than he got wrong. So this is a guy who wrote a long time ago. And the core thesis for a lot of his stories were you have to work hard, you have to prepare yourself, you have to be ready, but you can never know exactly what it is that's going to lift you to that next step. It's going to take you to that next step. You know, when I was leaving Castlight to work on what was ultimately a really ill-fated company, I was introduced to Owen by another friend of mine who worked there. And she suggested I talk to him because, boy, he'd done a lot in consumer-driven subscription businesses, which is what I thought I was building. And so if I went back and I said to myself, hey, you know what? Like, this business you're about to try and start is going to be a flaming hole in the ground in 6 months. You're about to have a kid. You're going to spend a bunch of money you don't have on building that flaming hole. Just don't do it. Well, I never would have been introduced to Owen. I never would have gone down this next path. And so I think, you know, it's not about always making the right decision. I think it is about being ready, working hard so that you can be ready when that opportunity presents itself, because you're never going to go to plan. If you stick too hard to that plan that you set for yourself, you're not going to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities that come along. You have to be responsive. You have to see what's happening at the time, and you have to be ready to make a change when it happens.
I love it. I love it there. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for doing so?
Folks can get me at evan@formhealth.co.
Amazing. Well, hey, Evan, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's been great.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.